Welcome back to the Roundtable. I'm Ian Pickus. Unlike many of his peers in the arts, actor Wendell Pierce was never afraid of leaving his native New Orleans for a shot at the big leagues. Trained at Juilliard, he went on to star on Broadway and on the screen, best known for roles in Selma, Tremé, and as homicide detective Bunk Moreland on The Wire, which Pierce calls the role of a lifetime.
Oh, no, no. The bunk is strictly a suit and tie, At all hazards, a man must keep up appearances. Dignity, I say. Dignity above all, Governor. Hear, hear.
The Tony Award winner is the host of the radio program Jazz at Lincoln Center, and has also appeared in films such as Ray, Waiting to Exhale, Malcolm X, Hackers, and dozens more. But Hurricane Katrina and its horrific aftermath drew Pierce back to the Pontchartrain Park neighborhood he grew up in, where he helped his elderly parents rebuild and brought live theater to a city looking for healing and guidance. Pierce's life in New Orleans is the subject of his new book, The Wind in the Reeds, A Storm, A Play, and The City That Would Not Be Broken. And it's my pleasure to welcome Wendell Pierce to the Roundtable. Thanks for being here.
Thank you for having me, Ian.
We just recently had the 10th anniversary of the storm, and I wonder how you marked the occasion.
I went back home to my community of Pontchartrain Park. We honored those that we lost, because that's the first thing we should do, always remember those we lost 10 years ago. And then we had testimonials of what people had gone through then and where we are now. And then we celebrated the fact that we exercised our right of self-determination, rebuilt our community, rebuilt 40 homes, saved this historic golf course designed by Joseph Bartholomew, and reconstituted one of the historic African-American neighborhoods, not only in the city and state, but in the country, Pontchartrain Park.
What does the anniversary mean to you personally? Because, you write about this. You went back to New Orleans for a vacation right as this storm hit and ended up really, having a family crisis, a citywide crisis to deal with.
Yeah, I arrived just days before Katrina did. And was with my family as we were in the storm about 70 miles outside the city, but still within the hurricane itself, lost power, and then started this decade-long journey of getting back, of bringing my neighborhood back. I wanted to make sure that my parents, who were elderly then, they made it back home before they died. They fought long and hard to get into that home, Pontchartrain Park. The neighborhood grew out of the civil rights movement. It was in the post-World War II, 1950s suburbia of New Orleans that blacks weren't allowed into the burgeoning neighborhoods. And A.P. Turow fought a valiant fight, a civil rights advocacy movement. It was then during Jim Crow that blacks weren't even allowed in green space and parks except one day out of the week, Negro Day on Wednesdays. And that advocacy to fight against that proved impactful. And the city's compromise was to create Pontchartrain Park, separate but equal from an equivalent white neighborhood. And still, that's an abhorrent thought, separate but equal. But we took something that was ugly and made it beautiful, and it became an incubator of African-American talent. Our first black mayor, Lisa Jackson, the EPA director in the Obama administration, Terrence Blanchard, Grammy Award-winning musician, jazz musician, and composer. And that's where the legacy of Pontchartrain Park was born. But we were in the deepest part of the flooding, and I knew that the work that had gone into it from that Moses generation, from my parents' generation, was passed on to us, the Joshua generation. It was blasphemous to even think we would let the destruction of the neighborhood go unchallenged. And so I put out a call to action that we exercise our right of self-determination. And that inspiration came from me coming back home and doing a play in the Lower Ninth Ward amongst the destruction and desolation of the Lower Ninth Ward. We did Waiting for Godot, a play about isolation and a void, just two characters searching for something to save them, define them. Where have they been? Where are they going? And in that play, there's a moment where one of the characters says, at this place, in this moment of time, all mankind is us. Let us do something while we have the chance. And that was an epiphany for me and an awakening. And I realized that's what art is, the forum where we reflect on who we are, where we've been, where we hope to go, declare our values, and then act on them. And so that moved me to return home, to rebuild my neighborhood, realizing that legacy of fortitude and resilience was in the history of Pontchartrain Park. And then I also looked at the legacy of my family, where that resilience and resolve had also been a part of my history for four generations in Louisiana. And it was all because of that epiphany in the moment of a play that reminded us of the power of art.
Did you think it was risky at all to put on Beckett for a group of people who had, you know, run into red tape and had a hard time getting calls back? They were living in an absurdist drama to some extent.
Yes, absolutely. But that's the great classic moment and the great classic nature of the play, that Samuel Beckett, this expatriate Irishman under duress in Paris under Nazi occupation, writes a piece that would speak across generations, across geography and time, because it speaks to that in our humanity that we share. The play spoke then when it was first done in the early 50s. It spoke again to our humanity in the Baltics and during the war when Susan Sontag did a performance of it there. And here once again in 2007 in the Lower Ninth Ward, where you had men and women from disparate walks of life, lawyers next to longshoremen, housewives, and teachers, all coming together who heard that clarion call and had that same cathartic moment that I had, that it is now at this place that we must find within ourselves the strength to move, to find within ourselves the strength to change our condition. And then I realized, as so many people do in New Orleans, that we live our culture more than anything else, more than most other places I know. Literally, our creativity when it comes to culinary arts, we take scraps of food with a little burnt flour and oil and create gumbo. Our creativity not only is moving, but it's literal sustenance. And going all the way back to Congo Square and the creation of jazz in New Orleans, where you had captured Africans taking that drumming of the African six and combining it with the oom-pa-pa of Europe, and it becomes oom-pa-pa-da-da-ba-ba jazz. And they found their creative freedom even before they found their physical freedom. So the legacy of the power of art and how transformative it can be is a part of our history in New Orleans, and was a part of that recovery in the Lower Ninth Ward when I did Waiting for Godot. And it's because of the classic nature of art that speaks to humanity across time and place and generation. It spoke to those people on that hallowed ground where so many people lost their lives in the Lower Ninth Ward.
We're speaking with Wendell Pierce, the author of The Wind in the Reeds. Shortly after you did the Beckett there in the Lower Ninth Ward, you came home to do Tremé about New Orleans. David Simon, you write, had effectively, written it for you. You had to get back to New Orleans. You were working on rebuilding your parents' house, a process that took a year. How important was it for you to be working there, too?
It was divine intervention. It was more than a television show for me. It was an opportunity to be home, not only to rebuild my parents' life, but also to spend the last years I had with my mother, to have that motherly love and lessons learned and taught, shared with me for one last time. And it made me understand that a piece of art like Tremé, and I do consider it art, it can have a therapeutic impact. Because people around the city would have watch parties on Sunday nights. And the fact that it was just a couple of years behind us, people were able to look at where we were in the city and find some solace and understanding in the fact that as we looked at where we were then, that yes, we had made some progress. Yes, it was moving forward, that we weren't just stuck in one place. It was a chance for people to purge themselves of grief, of loss, and fill themselves up with optimism and looking forward. And so it was like a group therapy session every week when people would sit and stop and watch and reflect on where we were as a city.
Listen, Kermit, you still got that gig at Vaughn's tonight, right? You got that going again.
Vaughn's still having it, man.
Yeah, crowd coming back, huh?
Coming back slowly but surely. Yeah. Coming back.
Listen, bro.
You need a gig, huh?
Oh, brother, I'm handing them out.
Oh, man, I got you. Come on down there to Vaughn's and swing out with us.
Right.
Come on down tonight.
Right. See, but the thing is, can I get an advance on that? Taxi outside got my bone in it.
You can't help it.
I got you.
Oh, good, man.
Oh.
Now there's this cultural document that years from now, when some little kid comes up to me and says, Mr. Pierce, what did you do in New Orleans' darkest hour? I'll be able to say, watch this. See Treme. See how culture rebuilt this city. See how this city is built on culture. And how culture is a transformative variable in your life. It is not just a piece of entertainment. It is tangible and real. And that is so much on display in Treme and so much on display when it comes to the culture of New Orleans. It is not arbitrary.
How do you think the city is doing now in 2015?
It is a tale of two cities. Yes, we should celebrate how we move forward, how we have rebuilt more businesses, school reform. There's been the improvement of the levees and the flood protection. But at the same time, there's a disparity in income. There's 100,000 poor residents and predominantly African-American that were forced out of the city. And that was not by chance. The first week of the disaster, on the front page of the Wall Street Journal, September 8th, 2005, James Reese and Ashton O'Dwyer, who are two men of business and industry in New Orleans, of the gentry class, literally said, we are going to get rid of the people we don't want. We're going to change this city demographically, geographically, and politically. And if it doesn't change, we're out of here. So they really threw down the gauntlet, and it wasn't by chance. They used their influence and to change policy, and passion has been put into the policy to make sure that that vision that they had would move forward. And a displacement of a lot of people, displacement by delay. If you delay projects that are just coming to completion, like public housing, just after 10 years coming to completion, the people that were living there before have already, you know, planted roots in other communities outside of the city, outside of the state normally. So it was by design. And so, like I say in the book, my legacy of my family and my grandfather and grandparents and my parents said to me, there will be those who don't have your best interest at heart. And that is a perfect example of how there were those who don't have our best interest at heart that put in the policy ideas that would make sure that large portions of people would not be able to come back to this new thriving New Orleans. So as bad people plot, good people plan. So that's why we in Pontchartrain Train Park and other communities came together and exercised our right of self-determination and are trying to combat those forces that don't see our communities as valid, that don't want to bring them back, that don't want to spend resources there. And so there are those who don't have your best interest at heart, but when bad people plot, good people plan. And we've exercised our right of self-determination, and we are coming back as well.
I have to ask you just a little about Bunk while I have you. You came up with the Marsalis brothers and discuss in the book the concept of shedding, which is basically you were, when you're acting, getting ready for a role, you would go to the woodshed and work on it and get ready and get your mind right. When a character is over, when the shooting is done, but you've done so much over years to, you know, become a character like Bunk Moreland, do you still check in on him mentally every once in a while as to where he might be today?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Bunk, first of all, was based on a real man. So I have a relationship with the real Bunk, Arthur Requeir, retired police detective in Baltimore. I consider him family. I think of Daryl Massey, another sergeant in the homicide, who I studied with in preparation for the role, and thought of them in the recent, uprising that was happening in Baltimore. Especially, the first thing people had to think of was all those issues that we brought up in The Wire over those 7 years that we worked on it, and the 5 seasons that we produced were the same issues that were coming to a head this summer. And I thought of those specifically black detectives on the police force who became policemen because the crime and the violence in that neighborhood produced by only 1% was not reflective of the good people in the neighborhood. And that's why they became police officers. That was developed in the script when Bunk Moreland had a relationship with Omar, you know, this homicidal burglar of the drug dens. And he said, listen, no more bodies. I don't want any more bodies.
My father had me on the street. But like any young man, I wanted to be hard too. So I would turn up at all the house parties where the tough boys hung. They knew I wasn't one of them. Them hard cases would come up to me and say, go home, schoolboy, you don't belong here. Didn't realize at the time what they were doing for me. As rough as that neighborhood could be, we had us a community. Nobody, no victim who didn't matter. And now all we got is bodies and predatory b****s like you. And out where that girl fell, I saw kids acting like Omar. Calling you by name, glorifying your ass, makes me sick how far we done fell.
The community also puts that challenge to the police officers. If you became a policeman because you feel as though this neighborhood is of great value, don't allow the few to ruin the relationship because of their behavior within your ranks as police officers. And that's what the community was saying back to the police officers this summer. In real life. So that form of art reflecting on all of those things shows you how powerful and influential and profound culture is. And it's not just a piece of entertainment. It's something of great substance and importance. And that dialogue, once you create a character, is something that you always go back to because it's the humanity that we all share and that we reflect on when we consider all the issues that we bring up in a piece of art that we created. And so the character of Bunt that I created, I constantly reflect on because I think of the men that helped me create it, like Sergeant Daryl Massey and the original Bunk, author Bunk Requeir, because they root me in the reality of those issues that are so profoundly important to act on today, especially in Baltimore.
Would you ever run for public office?
I guess you never say never, but I like to think that participating in the political process by just voting is you being a part of public office. Exercising our right to vote is the first act of your public civic persona. There's so many people who died to give me that right to vote. There's blood on that ballot box. And to exercise that right to vote is your first act as a public civic citizen. And so I like to think that I'm already in public office by being involved in the decisions that are going to impact my life and my family's life and my community's life by being aware and active in pursuit of it. Whether I go further in my public duties in the future, I don't know, but I already am involved.
All right, well, keep us posted. Wendell Pierce is the author of The Wind in the Reeds, A Storm, A Play, and The City That Would Not Be Broken. I'm a big fan of yours, and this was a great read, so I do really appreciate your time. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Ian, and have a wonderful day.
And you're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.